So the idea was to continue the theme from last week, the topic, which is thinking, to explore some of the aspects of thinking. Thinking is certainly a very important part of human life. It's unthinkable not to have it. But it's also something which meditators, and I think people who don't meditate, have to somehow contend with. And that some form of spiritual maturation or human maturation involves getting some good understanding, wisdom of the nature of thoughts, the activity of thinking, and how we relate to it all. So I started talking about it last week, and I'll continue today, and we'll see how it goes. I'll ask again at the end of today, like I did at the end of last week, whether we should continue the topic further, because I have a lot to say. I spent 3 years of my life living at Tassajara, which is a Zen monastery in Big Sur Mountains. And it's deep down the Ventana, I guess it's the Ventana National Wilderness. Anyway, we're deep down the mountains there. And long 14-mile dirt road that takes you up over a very high kind of pass and then down into this little valley, narrow valley. And it's far away from, you know, except the dirt road, it's far away from roads, there's no electricity that comes in. Nowadays they have a telephone, they have a satellite phone. They do make their own electricity, they have a generator. And during the winter time, it's closed to the public from about mid-September to end of May or so, end of April, mid-April, it's closed to the public. And there's this intensive period of Zen training that goes on during that time, winter time, fall and winter. And there was many, many hours each day, many hours spent in the meditation hall. And it was a very pristinely quiet place, the kind of place where, you know, you spend much time there, you naturally get quiet, very quiet. The person who drives the guests in during the summer says the guests talk a lot going in, but after they're there 3 or 4 days and they leave, they don't talk much. You know, they seem all happy. It isn't like they got depressed there. Now, they're all happy, but they're very settled and calm, and that calmness translates to, you know, this, you know, less chatter in the car. And so, you know, it's a kind of very quiet place. And so I spent hours in the valley, in this beautiful natural setting. I spent hours in the meditation hall with other people meditating, sitting, you know, and something about when people sit and meditate together, that there can at times be a kind of stillness or a silence in the room that is like a presence. It feels very palpable, and it's wonderful to feel it. And there can be a kind of wonderful resonance between a kind of sense of outer stillness and silence and some inner sense of stillness and silence. And it's just wonderful to be bathed in that, to sit there and kind of be there and feel that stillness, that silence. It can be very rich. It can be very nourishing to be in that kind of, sometimes in that kind of silence, that stillness. So with that kind of stillness as a contrast, which I valued so much when I was Tassajara, I want to offer you something to contrast that, and that is that I also spend many, many hours at Tassajara eating, pretty much every meal, most meals, were eaten in the meditation hall. And we would sit in the very place we'd meditate, we'd just turn around, face out towards the middle of the room, and we would sit in our meditation posture like this, and we had these bowls, and we'd, in silence basically, except for some chanting, we would put out the bowls, we'd get served. And if any of you have done a Japanese tea ceremony, a little bit like that. It's very elegant, it's very simple, and it's very nice. And people come and serve you, and you'd eat. And it probably spent probably 2.5, maybe hours a day as part of these 3 meals we'd have, because it was a ritualized meal and it was part of the practice. So we had all the silence, much of the time, silence in the room, silence in the valley, silence or meditation time, turn around, sit and have these hours of having our meals. And during this time of eating my meals, for one whole kind of cycle, from September to May, I spent most of my meals planning menus, analyzing the food, about how I would do it differently, and in one way or other, planning for the what I thought was going to be inevitable situation that I would be appointed to be the guest cook the following summer. Because in the summer they have guests, and they have it's kind of prestigious to be the guest cook, one of the three guest cooks, and make this wonderful guest food that they make down there. It's famous for its food down there. And I spent a year in the kitchen, and I'd been kitchen kind of manager, and I prided myself having learned to be a good cook and very capable in the kitchen and loved being in the kitchen. And I looked around, and I said, no one else is as capable as me. And of course, they're going to choose me next year to be the guest cook, nobody else. And so I prepared by thinking and planning the menus for the summer, from September to May, planning all the different menus I would do for the guests and, all this. So then, come end of April, it was time to announce people's assignments about what your job was going to be for the summer guest season. Gil Fronsdal, it's very formal, it's kind of a ritual, kind of list everybody's jobs and no one told me before, no one talked to me, what would you like to do? Or I just knew I was going to be the guest cook. And to my surprise, I was not assigned to the kitchen. I was assigned to be the guest manager, take care of all the guests, not the paying guests, but the guest students, the people who came down to experience the Zen life. And it was a bit of a shock to me. But the biggest shock was, what have I been doing this whole year? All those hours of thinking and planning and menu planning and thinking about food and all this. What a waste of time. It didn't go anywhere. It had no purpose. There was no, here I was doing this wonderful Zen training. My Zen teacher sometimes said we were getting this very expensive Zen training, he said to us. And so here I was, spending all these hours, 2.5 hours each day at least, thinking about an imaginary future about things like food and menus. So I was kind of embarrassed and kind of shocked. And it taught me a lot about my mind and how I can get caught up in thoughts and this contrast between the stillness and the silence and the mind that's busy and active and thinking and planning imaginary thoughts that never turn out to be the way you imagine was such a stark contrast for me. And what I've seen many times is that it's not so easy to turn off the thinking mind. It's one thing to, sit and experience the great majestic silence of some natural setting. It's wonderful to experience the silence, stillness of a meditation hall that can be quite still sometimes. And it's another thing to quiet the own mind, your own mind, and to have it be silent. There's an expression in Buddhism called noble silence, which refers primarily to the silence of a deeply meditative mind, a mind which is not caught up in all its discursive thoughts, not involved in the kind of surface chatter of the mind. The surface chatter of the mind quiets down, and there's a kind of mental silence that develops. It's called noble silence in Buddhism. And it's so rewarding. It's so healing, because one of the things to study or be aware of with thinking is the consequence thinking has on us. And last week I talked about all the tentacles or the connections that thinking has to our body, our emotions, our energy level, our motivations, our wishes in life, our beliefs, It's connected to our attention. It's connected to so many different things, our thinking. And because it's so connected to so many different things, you can feel the consequence of your thinking. And the more sensitive you are, more strongly you feel the consequence of how you're thinking. You know, thinking doesn't often happen without some kind of consequence for you to be thinking this way. So I saw it very clearly again at Tassajara when I was there. One year when I was in the kitchen that year, it was some time where it was a very intense time of very intense retreat time, extra intense. And I was working in the kitchen and I got a really bad cold. Now probably I shouldn't have stayed in the kitchen being sick, but in any case, I stayed in the kitchen. Somehow I had to work and keep going. But I was quite sick. And I noticed that in order to keep doing my work, I had to be very attentive to what I thought. Because certain thoughts, my system was kind of fragile because I was sick. And so I didn't have any much extra reserves. I was very sensitive being sick to, you know. And so I had to be very attentive to what I was thinking. Because if I thought some things, my energy level would kind of drop. And I wouldn't quite have the energy then to kind of keep doing the work. And if I thought other things, more beneficial or wholesome things, then I would have the energy and I'd be able to work. So there was a definite consequence between my thoughts. Another time, also Tassajara, they do this kind of, they don't call it this, but it could be called a hazing when you first get there. You're supposed to approve your mettle. Is that the right word in English, mettle? Or, you know, you kind of show that you're really kind of up to the snuff for being a Zen monk. And also, you know, to kind of really reflect on what you're about to do and how, you know, are you really up for it. And a variety of reasons for this. But there's this way of sitting when you first arrive there, where you can sit, you're offered a seat in the meditation hall, and except for half an hour after each meal and for sleeping at night, you're expected to sit in that seat, meditate. And so there's a long period between your break and the next meal. It's like three and a half, 4 hours sometimes. And you're expected just to sit there. You know, you weren't supposed to, you know, no walking meditation. And you were allowed to go to the bathroom, but you had to go quick, you know. And you had to sit there. And if you went to the bathroom a lot, then there was consequence for that. Because they're watching you, kind of. And if you fidget a lot, you're moving around and fidgeting a lot, you know. Because how long you sit in this rite of passage is anywhere from 5 to 10 days. And it's dependent on how still you sit. So if you sit well and still, then they come and tap you on the shoulder and say it's over. And you can kind of get up and join the monastery. But if you don't sit so well, you have to sit, you know, the whole 10 days. Needless to say, it's quite painful to sit that much. And especially my poor knees hurt quite a bit. And it was actually a very good experience for me. So I don't want to kind of put it down. But it was a very rich experience for me. But it was quite intense. And one of the things I learned was, again, the consequences of my thinking. And if I had certain kinds of thoughts about my knee pain, the knee pain would get worse. If I allowed myself, for example, to have thoughts of self-pity, poor Gil, I could feel the pain getting worse. But if I let go of those thoughts of self-pity, the pain would lighten up a little bit. I wouldn't tense or clench around the pain with my muscles. And so I learned, in order to survive this grueling rite of passage, I had to watch my thinking very, very carefully and not let my thinking get the upper hand and kind of take me off in some direction where I'd feel more pain. So, you know, I'm sure that most of you have had experiences in your life where you can feel the consequence of your thinking. You don't have to go sit through this intense rite of passage. You can probably just feel it in, you know, 101 during rush hour. You know, and you could blame the traffic on your tension and your headache, but that's not really honest, is it? I think that that's the condition for your headache, but the cause of your headache has much more to do with how you relate to the traffic and your thinking. Oh, I'm late, I can't get, you know. So there's always ways of thinking and relating that have consequences, cause tension in our body, or can cause relaxation. Can fill us with love, compassion, or can fill us with hate. And And I can feel in my own body, you know, that if I think, something continually, regularly, a long period of time, it has long-term consequences on my body. I can feel certain kind of tensions in my shoulders and my stomach that don't just let go that easily. You know, if I'm holding it for a while, then it takes a while for that tension to release and relax. So, you know, it's possible that certain kind of illnesses that arise from stress, tension, have its genesis in what we think and how we think. It's also that some of the most beautiful aspects of our human life come from thinking as well. Great experiences of inspiration, of realization, of joy, of understanding, of wisdom. It can come also from the realm of thinking, creativity, from thinking. So it's very helpful to kind of tune into the thinking and the consequences of thinking and then learn how to work with it. And anybody certainly who's going to learn meditation has to somehow become wise to the world of thinking and learn about it. And in the world of meditation itself, there's a variety of skills that need to be learned in relationship to thinking. And one of the ones that's most commonly mentioned, I think, is that of letting go of your thoughts, not having your thoughts have the upper hand, but to have you have the upper hand, for you to be in charge of your mind, in a sense, rather than your thinking mind be in charge of your mind. And it can be hard to do that because you can probably see that even some of you tonight probably found that you let go of some thoughts for a moment, but then it came right back. And just quieting the mind wasn't that easy. The mind has a mind of its own. And so in that sense, you're not free. And one of the aspects of freedom is if the mind is really free, you can choose whether you pick up or put down some train of thought. And even the most beautiful, important, necessary kinds of thinking that we do, important kinds of thinking, wonderful kinds of thinking we do, the fact that we are slave to it is camouflaged. We don't see it. We just do it. This is necessary. We're supposed to do this. But we don't see that we can't actually easily put it down. The momentum, the clinging to it, the obsession with it is there. And one of the things that meditation is trying to help us do is to develop the fluidity of mind, the flexibility of mind, the freedom of mind, so that we can begin choosing where we put our mind, our thinking, so that we can put down things we don't want to focus on and perhaps pick up things we do want to focus on. And I do this in my life all the time. I choose what I focus on. There are times I decide this is not a useful line, this is not what I want to be thinking about right now. I'd rather focus on this and focus on, and have some focus on this. And it's been a very useful skill to have that fluidity. And there have been some times in my life where I've been really caught by something and I haven't been able to make that switch. I really want to think about X, but Y is just bugging me and I just can't get out of my system. And in that kind of situations, I'm kind of, in a sense, caught in the thinking mind. The thinking mind has the upper hand. So meditation can show us how unfree we are in relationship to thought, but it's not necessary to despair. It's just a very important insight to see. And then we begin to learning how to work with the realm of thinking. And so in the realm of meditation teaching, we put a lot of emphasis not so much on how to think or what to think about, but a lot about how to let go of thoughts, how to become free of the grip of thinking. Maybe another day, if we continue this series on thinking, I can talk about some of the aspects of wise thinking, you know, how to engage in thinking in a wise way, which maybe is a little bit unusual in Buddhism, because Buddhism, being a meditation tradition, focuses so much on that aspect of thinking that has to do with becoming free of them. But it's also important to address the question of what is wise thinking? How do we engage thinking in a useful way? So in the teachings of the Buddha, there's a wonderful discourse called Two Kinds of Thoughts, I think it's called. Two Kinds of Thoughts. And here the Buddha recounts a situation before he became enlightened. And he says, before I became enlightened, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes, two categories of thinking. This is from the Middle Length Discourses, number 19. And in one category, I place, would have placed, thoughts of sensual craving, ill will, and cruelty, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of hatred. So on one hand, he had these unskillful, unwholesome kinds of thinking, aversion, strong desire and clinging. In the other class, he put a category of thinking that he called thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. Non-ill will is understood by the tradition to mean, explicitly to mean, thoughts of loving kindness. Non-cruelty is explicitly understood to be thoughts of compassion. Renunciation is considered a very positive thing in Buddhism that's not conveyed very well with the English word renunciation, because the Pali word doesn't mean give up something. The Pali original, like renunciation does, the Pali word means, the Buddhist word means to go out, to go forth, go out into the open air after being confined in some dusty, you know, confined, you know, dusty household life, like cabin fever. You have been in a cabin for a long time, then you know, you go out into the open air, it just feels great, that freedom, that openness. So the Buddha is putting, is dividing up his thinking into two categories, into what can be called healthy or helpful thinking, and that which is unhelpful or unhealthy, or unskillful. So helpful and unhelpful, healthy, unhealthy. And then he thinks, then he reflects, what are the consequences of these kinds of thinking? Do they lead to my own benefit or to my affliction? Do they lead to the benefit of others, or to the, does it afflict them? Or does it lead to my own and others' benefit, or to my own or others' affliction? So he's just asking, interesting question. Now that I have recognized these two categories, what are the consequences of these? And he recognized that some, one category of thoughts, are afflictive, cause suffering, have consequence on us that it causes suffering for us. Another category of thoughts which are beneficial. So he's dividing up these two classes of thoughts. And then he says, it's very interesting. This is a very famous little quote. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of mind. So if you think about the same thing over and over and over again, you develop a habit of mind, an inclination. Your mind tends to go in that direction more and more. And so you want to be careful with what you... So what are the consequences of what you think? Is it sets kind of a disposition in your mind. And how you shape your dispositional self, almost, you know, little parts of your personality almost, because dispositions are closely connected to personality, is partly shaped by what we repeatedly think over and over and over again. So if we're constantly thinking thoughts of ill will or hatred or anger or aversion, it actually shapes our disposition, so we're more inclined to think that way in the future. If we start thinking more and more in friendly ways, looking at the good aspects of people, not in an idealistic or simplistic way, but actually looking and kind of noticing, you know, beauty in people, this inner beauty in people, then it inclines us to see the beauty in people. And I've known in my own life a big shift in my life that I really found very important for me, is that shift to be able to see more and more, I mean, incline myself more and more to appreciate what's beautiful about people. And, you know, it's easy enough to incline the mind to look at what's not so nice about people. Everyone has something which is not so nice about them, isn't it true? I know there may be one or two exceptions here, so I don't want to, you know, generalize for all of you. That's bad, right? To generalize, I don't want to. But everyone has something that you know. So I could fixate on that. If I started fixating on that, people wouldn't hang out with me much. But, you know, I find myself, without fixating on it, I find myself now inclining more and more to appreciate what's beautiful in people. So you have to pay attention to what you think, because there are long-term consequences besides just the consequences of tension here and now. So the unskillful or the afflictive thought thinking we might have, you need to be on the guard for. And the Buddha encourages us to kind of drop them, to somehow let go of them, to somehow be on the lookout so they don't have the upper hand. And then he had an analogy. He said, if there's a... a cow herder, someone herding cows, and it's the growing season in India, so the rice is growing, the plants are growing, and the cows, you know, are out there eating the weeds and the grass and stuff. You have to be very attentive and alert as they walk around the rice paddies to make sure that the cows don't eat the neighboring farmer's rice. And so you have to be right there with the little kind of cowpoke, kind of pushing them all the time and, you know, don't go there, and just always kind of be right, riding them really close and making sure they don't get into trouble. So in the same way, sometimes if we have an inclination or tendency to think certain kinds of thoughts, certainly certain kind of extreme thoughts, sometimes it takes a lot of mental discipline and effort to keep saying no to them. Don't act on that. Don't say that. Not now. And, you know, not normal life perhaps, but maybe in certain kind of extreme situations where certain people have very strong addictive qualities or strong... something. Sometimes you have to be very vigilant sometimes with your mind. Not now. Now, for the other class of thoughts, when that are skillful or for your benefit, certain thoughts are beneficial for you, then the Buddha referred to them as being, he said, if I think and ponder upon these beneficial thoughts, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. Nothing to fear. No problems with it. And when those kinds of thinking are there, then good thoughts, helpful thoughts, beneficial thoughts, then in relationship to them, you can be like the cow herder in after the harvest, after the rice has been harvested, and all the stubble is left in the rice fields. Then the cows can roam around and eat whatever they want. And then the cow herder has to stay mindful, aware, but the cow herder can rest up against the tree, the trunk of a tree, just keep their eyes open and look out across the fields, but they, you know, make sure they don't wander off or the tigers don't eat them or something. But they don't have to go kind of riding them, poking them, avoiding the rice paddies. So you just kind of be much more relaxed, at ease, you know, laying those thoughts. So it can be a very different relationship to our thoughts depending on what we're thinking. But then he goes on to say this very interesting thing. He says, certain kinds of thoughts are beneficial. There's nothing to fear in them. There's no blame. There's no problems with having those kinds of thoughts. But if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. When the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. When the mind becomes disturbed, it is far from concentration. So, I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. So this is a very interesting statement. That even if you have good, healthy, wonderful kinds of thinking, one of the consequences for it is it can be tiring. Now, normally in life, we don't necessarily see how much energy goes into thinking. Like I said earlier, you can see that sometimes if you get sick. Or if you're really tired, sometimes you can see it's, you know, how tiring thinking can be. But you can see it very well on meditation retreats. And because somehow the stillness or the calm that comes in, and the refinement of attention that can come on meditation retreats, you can actually see much more and highlight the consequences of your incessant thinking, you know, ongoing thinking. And you can feel how tiring it is. Sometimes on meditation retreats where people are really meditating a lot, it can be a surprise to discover how there's an underlying layer of weariness in the mind, of tiredness in the mind, that maybe they had no idea was there. But it's a tiredness from the mind always being busy thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking. It's never occurred to the mind it doesn't have to think. You know, there can be an addictive quality, the addiction to thinking, It can feel, our relationship to thinking can be so intimate that we think that we are our thoughts. That if we don't think, then we don't exist. And so it's very important to keep thinking. It's very important to figure things out. It's plan our future. It's all this stuff. And it's actually a tiring thing for the brain to be doing. And I don't know so much about the physiology of the body, but I've heard or read that the biggest, usually in a normal kind of life, unless you're a marathon runner perhaps, the biggest expenditure of energy in the human body is used by the brain. And I suspect a lot of that has to use with thinking, because I've seen, and I've, myself and other people, who begin to kind of in meditation retreats quiet the discursive thoughts. So the ongoing level of discursive thinking is not running away and going on and on. The need for food drops down. The need for oxygen drops down. You know, oxygen is needed to process the energy, right? And get the energy going through the body. And so it's quite common phenomena for deep meditation for people's breath to get stiller and stiller until finally it seems like a person's not breathing at all. And I suspect that part of the reason for that is that you simply don't need so much oxygen anymore because you're not expending so much because your mind is becoming stilling and quiet. People on meditation retreats generally, especially long ones, really long ones, and get settled into it, will find that they don't need as much sleep anymore. And like when I sit my long retreats, I usually do really well with about 4.5 hours of sleep. Whereas, normal life, I do best with 6.5 or 7 hours of sleep. And I've known people on meditation retreats who for long periods of time, weeks on end, have gone with 2 hours of sleep. And I remember once I sat at a retreat, and as far as I could tell, the woman sitting near me, I couldn't see that she ever slept. Except every once in a while, a few times during the day, she would just kind of fall forward and have her forehead would be on the floor for a while, and, for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. Maybe she's doing a cat nap, and then she'd sit up. And she seemed to always be practicing. And now, in normal life, if you don't go without sleep or have such little sleep, there's a danger of psychosis. But on meditation retreats where you don't need as much sleep, you're getting plenty of rest from this deep meditation, then I don't think there's that problem with psychosis. So so even thinking about healthy things can be a disturbance to the mind, tiring to the mind. If you really want to cultivate the deep, still mind, it's necessary to begin to learn how to let go of any thoughts at all. And then you can be freer from your thinking. So then what are the strategies for learning to work and let go or stop thinking certain things? And so there's a lot of different strategies. The most common one, as I've said, is learning to let go of your thoughts. Probably one of the most common instructions in meditation is if you notice you're thinking, just let go of it and go back to the breath. Just let go, as if it's easy to do. What? And easy for you to say. The Buddha gave discourse 20 in the middle length discourses, gave five different strategies for how to remove distracting thoughts. So I'll go through this somewhat quickly. Are you still with me? Or is this getting too boring? Are you still with me? Yeah? Sometimes I never know, just have these monologues. It's if you like to have monologues and become a meditation teacher. I go to parties and stuff, I couldn't do it there, wouldn't get away with it. But this way, I just talk and talk and talk. And if I go to some places, some Buddhist cultures, the Dharma talks are really long. Here, it's 45 minutes, but, sometimes in Thailand, they go on for hours. So if I really have a big need to talk, I'll go there. So there's five techniques for removing thoughts, distracting thoughts. Um, So the first is to have some sense of why you are thinking unskillful or unhelpful thoughts. What stimulated it? What is there some idea, some concept that you're focusing on that's kind of stimulating them? And if it is, then one idea is to switch focuses on the mind and focus on some concept or idea which is helpful or wholesome. So you're actually changing the direction of the mind. So if you're spending a lot of time planning how to get revenge on your neighbor, if you have trouble with your neighbor, that's not a good thing to do. You know, after a while, you realize this is not a good thing to do. I don't want to think this way anymore. So rather than kind of have this idea of neighbor, you know, maybe your neighbor on your right-hand side is just a real problem, but the neighbor on the left-hand side is a saint. So you switch and you say, well, let me think about the other neighbor, the saint, for a while. Or let me think about, you know, Dalai Lama, or let me think about, you know, somebody who inspires me. And just shift the focus on something which is, you know, more positive. And that's one way. So, you know, this is not, so the first thing that Buddha offered is not to let go of your thoughts, but shift the focus of what your mind is concerned about, what it's thinking about, what's, you know, on its mind. So that can work sometimes. However, if this doesn't work, then you should reflect a little bit about what he calls here the danger in these thoughts. So, or the downside, the disadvantages that come from this thinking, what you're thinking about. So this involves a little bit an analysis, a discursive analysis, about what, you know, I'm thinking about my neighbor, I'm thinking about planning my revenge, and, you know, this is not healthy for me. This is creating a disposition for me, it's causing stress for me, it's causing me to kind of reinforce this idea that my neighbor is a terrible person. And if I keep dwelling on these kinds of thoughts, I might do something unplanned. Next time I see my neighbor, I might punch him out. So I don't think this is a good line. This is dangerous. Think this way. It's dangerous for me. It's dangerous for him. I think that, and you get a sense of the danger. You get a sense of the consequence. It's not beneficial. Sometimes just that, you'll just naturally kind of want to pull away. No, enough of this. I don't want to do this anymore. And sometimes it might, I've known people, and I've done this, where it takes a long time to realize, enough of this, this is not good. And when I really get a clear sense, this is not good, then there can be a release, a letting go. Okay, enough of this. So this can be helped by some kind of examination. If that doesn't work, then the meditator should try to forget those thoughts and should not give any attention to them. So this is kind of like letting go. This is kind of trying to let go and not give any attention to those kinds of thinking. And there's a variety of ways of doing this. One way is to pour your attention into your breath, if you're doing breath meditation. If you're, you know, our attention is kind of like fuel. Our attention is kind of like energy, fuel, food. Maybe food is a good analogy. And what we put our attention to feeds what's getting the attention. So if your attention, your primary attention is going to something unhelpful, unhealthy, you're actually in some ways fueling that tendency. So if you're thinking a lot about your neighbor, and all your attention goes into revenge for your neighbor, you're fueling your sense, your revengeness, you're fueling your animosity, you're fueling your, you know, your tension, you're fueling all kinds of things that's not helpful. If you take the, if you, with active will, you take your attention and shift it to focus on your breathing, some aspect of you might still be thinking about your neighbor, but, you know, a majority of your attention, the food, is going into feeding the breath meditation. That is what's going to get fed, and not so much food is going to go to your unwholesome thinking anymore. And so some people can have a very disciplined mind and able to just redirect their attention to something like the breath and just ignore those thoughts. And there's a great wisdom to just ignoring what you're thinking about in meditation. Just ignore it. Just focus on something else. And I've had, you know, great success just letting thoughts be kind of in the background and not given much credence, much importance. Let the mind do what it wants to do with thinking, and I'm just going to focus myself on sitting here meditating, being with the breath. This has an added advantage because you're kind of severing the relationship you have with the unhealthy thinking. And whenever you're relating to something, you're actually still feeding it because attention is going into it. So if you're relating, generally, if you're relating to something unhealthy you're doing, you know, you're engaged, I don't like this, I'm trying to get rid of it, I'm trying to stop it, you're actually in some ways perpetuating it, giving it food. And sometimes if you stop relating to it, judging it, criticizing it, trying to push it away, trying to stop it, put a lot of energy into trying to stop it, I've got to stop this thing, just ignore it. Then, you know, don't be bothered by it. Don't let yourself be bothered by those kinds of thoughts. Just let them be in the background like pesky little flies. And you can put your attention on your breath or doing loving kindness meditation or something else. Then they just quiet down on their own. But if you're yelling at them, be quiet, stop thinking, you know, they get fed. They just get happy. Great. So, then if that doesn't work, so this is, that you can't let go of them, if you can't forget them, if you can't ignore them and focus on something else, then the Buddha says you should focus on calming the thought formation of those thoughts. Thought formation is an interesting term. Thinking does not happen in isolation with other aspects of our psychophysical being. And so if there's a lot of persistent thoughts that you can't let go of, chances are that there's other aspects to that phenomena that involve some kind of tension, pressure, stress, and tightness. And so, you know, you're caught in something. So you're thinking about something a lot. You're probably, you know, your eyebrows kind of bunch up, your frown, your jaws might clench, sometimes I've felt even my nose kind of tighten up if I think certain things. My neck, my shoulders, my diaphragm area. Occasionally I felt it in my rib cage. I felt it in my stomach area. Occasionally I felt it in my back. You know, but in particular for me, I feel it sometimes in the kind of inside my skull, in the area that we call our brain. And it's almost as if the brain is a thinking muscle. It's like a muscle in there that gets really tight or feels a lot of pressure if I'm really caught up in some kind of thoughts or thinking. So if you can feel the tension, the pressure that's connected somehow to your thinking, that's supporting it, that's part of it, then the focus can be on ignoring what you're thinking about, but focus on that pressure, focus on the tension, and then relax the thinking mind, relax the thinking muscle. Soften it. Maybe every time you breathe out, smooth it out. Every time you breathe out, soften around it. Soften the middle of it. Relax it. So your shoulders, relax the shoulders. Relax the jaws. Relax the face. And sometimes that's a much more efficient way to let go of thinking than letting go of the thoughts themselves. If you letting go of the tension. Because the tension, if it remains, it seems to be kind of like a factory to pump out new thoughts. And if you leave the factory on, operating, then it's going to spit out new thoughts. And you can let go of thoughts forever, but it just spits out new ones. But if you can go and kind of turn off the motor in the factory, then new thoughts don't get produced. So you find where the tension or the pressure or the stress is in the system and start smoothing and relaxing it. That's another way. And then finally, the last way that the Buddha offers in this sutra is not for the faint-hearted. It's only to be done in really extreme situations. It should be done wisely. Maybe you can talk to a meditation teacher before you try this way. It's dangerous. But there might be, an occasion or two where this will save your life. So if doing these previous strategies haven't worked, with unwholesome thoughts connected with hate, clinging, and delusion, then, with teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one should beat down, constrain, and crush the mind with the mind. When with the teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with clinging, hate, and delusion are abandoned and subside. With the abandoning of these, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too should you. So these nonviolent Buddhists. So it's pretty extreme, but I think there might be an occasion where the mind has such power over us, such motivation, such intensity to it, that you know, that something really powerful medicine is needed. And like, if you're filled with anger. I remember once being in the Zen monastery in Japan, and there was this monk next. You know, we slept in the meditation hall, we ate in the meditation hall, and we meditated in the meditation hall. We were always there, and there was this monk next to me who hated me. And I'm not sure why, but he hated me. And he was doing things. And we sit there meditating. He'd poke me, or he would do all kinds of things to me. And you know, I'd be sitting there. And it kind of got to me after a while. And there was one time where I almost punched him out. I don't know if I'd be the first person ever to punch someone out in the meditation hall, but you know, I just, you know, the heat started rising, and it took effort, you know, not to give in to that. And I'm glad I did. It would have been probably lethal for me to have done that in that context. And I had to kind of constrain myself, beat down that strong impulse. Because this was not going to be healthy for anyone, especially me. And so I don't know if you've had that kind of situation, but or I remember many years ago also. Well, maybe I shouldn't tell the story. But I succeeded in restraining myself. It had a good outcome. That's all you need to know. it wasn't hate this time. So you know, there are times when the mind has this tremendous, you know, power, and sometimes you know, the wisest thing is just kind of hold it in check. And so five different strategies. So the Buddha divides thoughts into two categories, those which are helpful and those which are not. Even the helpful ones, if you do it a lot, doesn't give you the deep kind of peace and rest that we're all capable of, deep sense of well-being, deep inner peace and stillness. Doesn't open the doors to this realms of liberation and freedom. So an important part of a meditative life, a Buddhist life, an important part of a life of becoming free is to learn how to become free of even healthy thoughts, good thoughts. And so how do we do that? Here there's five different ways the Buddha offered. And think about something else. What are they five? Think about something else. Forget those thoughts, ignore them. Now my mind... What? Investigate the danger behind them, kind of analyze what you're doing and what's going on here, and calm down the thought formations, the inner kind of physical kind of aspect, the physical manifestations of that thinking, the tension and stuff that might be there. And then in the very rare occasions that necessary, you really have to kind of hold tight and clench down and not give in. Occasionally that's the right call. So that's some more thoughts about thoughts. And again, as I said last week, part of my motivation in talking about thoughts like this is to provoke, is that the right word? To encourage, provoke, inspire you to give renewed attention to your thinking and how you relate to your world of thoughts. And so one of the things you might do over this next week is look at your thinking and just notice what you're thinking in the course of the week, different times. And then see if in a very kind of easy way you can start putting some categories, some thoughts, some into the unhelpful category. These are unhelpful thoughts to have. And other thoughts in the helpful category. Just do that very simple analysis. And if you can't decide, just, you know, you don't say it's neither helpful or unhelpful, then just let it be. But see if you can, what happens to you if you start kind of just have very simple analysis. Oh, this is unhelpful. See what goes on. And then the final question for you, would you like more discussion about thinking next week? Or is this enough? You're saturated. For tonight you are, but you know, it's a week away. More thinking? Yeah. So those of you who don't think, you know, you can come Sunday morning. And it will, you know, and so thank you very much.